Welcome to Truest Blood, the official True Blood podcast.
I'm Kristen Bauer.
And I'm Deborah Ann Wohl.
And you've been invited in. I want to do bad things here. Welcome back to Truest Blood, where we sink our fangs into the series bite by bite.
This week, we have the inimitable Fiona Shaw. Her work as Marnie Stonebrook is weird and wonderful.
Yes.
And it was such an honor to have her on the show, and even more so to have her sit with us on the podcast.
Such an honor. She is absolutely incredible in the role. She's incredible in life. She's incredible on everything that she's in. I'm so thrilled that I got to work with her. Really just one epic scene.
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, we spoke to Dennis or, you know, O'Hare earlier this season. We're now speaking with Fiona Shaw and this, you know, two very unique, specific, but such effective takes on an antagonist, right? And how you can, you know, approach that. And it was just, I've been looking forward to this interview so much.
I know. Two of the best actors in the business.
But first, let's have a quick bite.
One season in the life of Sookie Stackhouse. It's that time again. Time to check in on our girl, Sookie. See how she's hanging in there. Life is hard when you're a magnet for trouble, and we've got her back. Let's dig into some Stackhouse stats.
Season 4 takes place over 10 days, give or take a year. It seems 10 minutes fairy time equals 525,600 Earth minutes, in case you were wondering.
Now, the on-again, off-again nature of Bill and Sookie's relationship has been a key trend in our analysis. This season we have, count it, zero Bill and Sookie breakups. In the Sookieverse, she and Bill broke up 10 minutes ago on day 48, although for him it's been 413 days. But it's no problem because...
this season is all about the amnesiac suite of her dreams. On day 53, she is hot and heavy with Eric. This bliss lasts a generous 4 days before he gets his memory back and stuff gets complicated. And once again, she ends the season a strong single lady.
Kill counts. Here we go.
Okay. Deaths in Sookie's vicinity. We have Granddad Earl, Fairy Godmother Claudette, Marnie and her minion Roy, Jesus, and Tara. A total of 6 for this season and 17 overall. Shit's getting real, Sookie.
Deaths at Sookie's hand this season. Just 1. Debbie Pelt, upping Sookie's personal total to 3 in the span of 2 months. That makes 3 self-defense murders in 2 months. Can we get a girl some therapy?
Day 58 is Halloween, which means we can backdate some of our favorite moments. Sookie returns to Bon Temps on October 21st, which Jason informs her is roughly 12 and a half months since she disappeared. Let's call it 54 weeks for our guesstimate. Now that tells us...
day 1 of the entire series is likely August 21st. Bill and Sookie's anniversary of their first date is August 23rd. Jessica was made on September 3rd. Her death day stone would be a sapphire. And Tara's birthday falls around September 25th, making our fire-tongued heroine, ironically, a Libra.
It will be interesting to see how these dates hold up as we move into season 5 and winter on the bayou.
Fiona Shaw is an Irish-born actress. She's been nominated 19 times for roles in television, film, and on stage, and won 6 awards, including an Emmy, and was even named an honorary commander of the Order of the British Empire for her services to drama.
Oh, she trained at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts, worked with the Royal Shakespeare Company, and starred in more A-list projects than we can list, including My Left Foot, 3 Men and a Little Lady, and all the Harry Potter movies as Petunia Dursley.
And you can now see her on HBO's True Detective, Night Country, streaming now on Max. But today, we will be asking her all about her portrayal on True Blood of the Wiccan coven leader and necromancer Marnie Stonebrook, who melted my face, almost sucked Jessica into the daylight, and then nearly burned Eric and Bill, our daddies, at the stake. And you may hear some audio hiccups with her joining us from London, but the conversation itself is still so great.
So without further ado, from Muggle to Witch, the Fiona Shaw. Fiona!
Yay!
We finally made it happen.
This is like unbelievable that you squeezed us in to the most... I mean, you must be working. It must be there as a SAG rule that you have to be in everything and theater. I mean, you really are just, I had to internet stalk you for this interview and you have so many projects on the air coming up. It's really amazing.
Yeah.
Actually, more coming up than I'm doing. I'm just wanting at the moment. There's a lot stacked up, but of course the strike held us all up. And
yes,
I think things are beginning to come out now.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. Well, we have many, many, many questions. Deb and I are so excited to talk to you.
Yeah. I mean, we've been, after this fourth season, you know, seeing your performance as Marnie and Antonia and Marnie evolving. I mean, it's you know, such a fascinating role. And, you know, we usually like to start this with just like, how did you get the part? And what did you think coming into this experience?
Well, I was in Dublin playing in the most unhappy production I think I've been in for years, which was John Gabriel Bateman with Alan Rickman, God rest his soul.
Huh.
And I was in my dressing room one night, and a phone call came into the dressing room. And I went, oh, Alan Ball. Hello, Alan. And he said, you know, True Blood. I said, I don't know True Blood. Not sure I'm a target audience for True Blood.
Yeah.
I thought at that moment I would have gone into, you know, the hounds of hell's throats. So how it happened was then I said, I'd love to. And I came and hung around to see. They wanted to shoot something before Christmas.
Oh.
So I just went to have a look. Mm. And you all look so gorgeous. I was very in awe of everybody, not least making some decisions that perhaps I would have made different decisions. My hair was the disaster in that show. So I really enjoyed, you know, jumping from Henrik Ibsen to True Blood. I loved it.
Mm. And did you know from the start the arc of your character, or did you have to go script by script?
Well, I think I only knew, you know, the tiniest.
Okay.
They knew.
Mm-hmm.
Alan, who was, you know, incredibly fluent and so knowledgeable about it, obviously. And then I met that lovely Audrey Fisher, the costume designer.
Oh, yes.
That's so imaginative. I love that. And
yeah.
I was kind of lonely because I didn't really, my friends who had given me the guest house wasn't there. So I was kind of alone up in Bel Air. But then I had this lovely group. And of course, I had Retina.
Yeah.
Who else in my group? Well, Lauren.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you had Lauren.
Lauren Boyles, yeah. And Kevin.
And Kevin.
You had Nelson.
Nelson.
I mean, Nelson. I mean, he was kind of the one who was going to take over the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we all felt that very strongly.
Yeah, and then, you know, you guys were a bit enemies to me. And of course, then when the plot changed, they got the most gorgeous person in South America to play the younger version of me.
Paola, yeah. Well, so to that end, I'm curious, because you have the unique experience that a few people on the show have had of having to, in some way, kind of mimic another person or bring their energy and essence into you as a possessed person or sort of taking them on. And I'm curious, the challenges of that, the process, how do you do that? Could you work with Paola? You know, are there ways, you know, how did you manage that?
I think we thought we had to do a lot of that. In fact, you know, when you think now that 12 years ago or something?
Something.
There was brilliant work done between eyes cutting and eyes touching, wind blowing and, you know, face morphed onto other faces. There was great confidence in the show, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I remember Alan summoning me to his office to test out my Spanish, I think, or Spanish accent.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing it, what I thought was good, my accent. as the girl so that we had a kind of shared accent. And then his pug dogs jumped up on the sofa and he said, I think you're going to be okay. He said, the dogs like you. Who knew?
Yeah, I remember when we were filming that night at Greer. So I'm so glad that I got to work with you a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was the night that you cursed my face.
Yeah.
And right, and it was so cold. And I had this huge prosthetic thing coming up that I was very worried about. And we had done many tests and I had to really not screw it up. And, but I remember that when you had to turn to Antonia Marnie, that, and you had to do these incantations. And then at one point,
we've taken to calling her Martonia, which I think is fun.
Yeah, Martonia.
Martonia.
And at one point, you had to, you know, you just started laughing. And I don't know if I said it out loud because that happened to all of us because we had to do these ridiculous
Silly things.
And you know, you practice them at home, but then there's something about the first time you do it in front of everybody in the crew. I mean, it sort of leads into a topic I wanted to ask you about. A couple of things. One is that we keep running into people who have been on the show acting and writing and who come from theater.
Yeah.
And a huge percentage of our actors and writers did because, I mean, we have theories about this, but it comes from, I think, getting actors who can make this crazy stuff believable and grounded. And I'm wondering for you, because you go back and forth between TV, film, theater, in America and in Europe, mm-hmm. There's two-part question, really, but I wonder how that works for you and how that balance. Are you just used to these different venues and formats of acting? Is there a different process for each one?
Well, sort of just each project, but I think True Blood was unique because it was very well written, and so I was always interested in good text. I mean, I didn't know what a necromancer was. And
right.
I made a bird fly, and I thought, I'm not going to do this. You know, this is all before CGI, I think. They got a real bird, lay down. Oh, he pushed in the bird flew. I mean, it was...
Oh, my gosh.
They had a trained bird, and I had to make a spell on that bird. That bird did that, and then it got up, and it flew.
Even paws in the air.
There was no expense there, but I think it was a wonderful web of sociological mapping of the thick America, wasn't it? Without being political. It was socially political, and it was social-sexually political, wasn't it? It was liberalism versus non-liberalism, and that wonderful complexity that somehow the vampires were a tiny bit more organized, and the crazies were a bit more democratic or more, you know, because all democracy is a mess. There's always that tension.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow, when I saw those first three seasons, I was blown away. Season one, season two, they were just knockout.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, they're great.
Wasn't episode one about equal rights for vampires?
Yeah, they were fighting for marriage rights and things like that, you know, outside. So, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I think Alan always talked about it as like... you know, they fool you with sort of the popcorn eating elements of it and then kind of slip in some thoughtful discourse.
Debate.
Yeah, some debate.
But that's what it is. It's debate.
Yeah. Yes.
Is what it had in it.
A conversation about it. Yeah.
So it wasn't just sort of anecdotally eccentric.
Yeah.
If you were representing a sort of debate in America. So, you know, its serious underbelly was very, very good.
Yeah. I mean, I think exactly to that point, what we always loved about it is that we had so much fun.
Yeah.
And there were silly moments and you felt ridiculous at times, but we felt very strongly about it. We didn't think we were making a silly show. We thought we were making something very important. Yeah.
I think it'll come back again.
Yeah, I hope so. They made us do syndication, and I was like, how are you ever going to show this on an airplane? And then now they can. So.
Yeah, I think it'll play again and again because of the politics of it. But the idea that vampires would be walking among us and they may want to be the same as us such a wonderful imaginative idea.
Yeah. Well, and that's interesting then, too, because for Marnie, in your role, you're representing a, again, we talk about this as being a great debate or conversation, because you are in many ways representing a view that is contrary to the, that vampires should be free to walk among us and all of that. However, still a very grounded, very lived-in experience of why maybe not, because there was true trauma there.
Yes. The other thing I had to play, I mean, yeah. sorry.
Of course.
Is that it brings back that I had to study this woman who was Miss Ordinary, Miss Low Grade, not very intelligent, working down, you know, some low grade tiny place where she had a shop or something, a store. I think the meetings were held in her garage. And that was another sort of metaphor for a lot of America, where people haven't really access to something bigger than themselves, but they have an aspiration to something bigger than themselves. She was the leader of this group, but she was neither equipped, and she was terribly shy in life.
Yeah.
And that was a very interesting thing to play. And it was, you know, that premise was very strong.
Yeah.
Deb and I didn't watch the show while it was airing. Somehow it was just too, like...
Intense
to, like, see myself or think about whatever. But as we've been watching it for this... So we've gone from not watching it to Uber watching it like four times through, right? But it's, we're so continually impressed with the layers in the writing. So, right, a lot of people love it just for the frosting, but there is some incredible content here. And, you know, Dennis O'Hare, another accomplished theater actor, you know, getting this incredible dialogue that you had and he had about this concept of humans being dangerous creatures and the vampires representing dangerous creatures, but really not as dangerous as humans have been.
Or certainly not any more dangerous.
Certainly not any more dangerous. And Marnie got to play in that sandbox. And I'm wondering if this is like just a completely selfish question, but I wonder if from your experience, Britain to us just seems so civilized and fair and farther ahead, personally. That's my view. I'm wondering if the industry, acting in the industry in Europe and here, how that felt different from the negotiation through the process, showing up on the set. You know, you did have a very Hollywood experience. But is it more civilized over there being in the business?
No. The thing that it has here that you guys deserve, you know, hats off all around, is that you all have to jump off a cliff and hope you land in the employment.
Yeah.
The thing that happens here is that, you know, if you go to drama school as I did, to RADA, and then you usually, if you do well there, you get seen there. So you have this small little funnel that you're seen at these various showcases. Agents come and producers come. If you win a few prizes, as I did, having been a very slow starter, you suddenly get picked up and put into, in my case, the National Theatre and then to the Royal Shakespeare Company. And during those years, you're put into bigger parts. So by 25 or 6 or 7, you're playing the leading parts on these big stages.
Right.
You're kind of being trained for about another 5 years.
Yeah.
And also, I think a lot of people wouldn't have the patience. I spent 4 years at the RSC. I don't think I would do that now. I learned a ton, so nothing frightened me afterwards. I think things frighten you, but not in terms of feeling not ready to know how to negotiate, how you might approach them. And I think that ladder was very useful to actors. Mm. And Americans don't have that. I think, I mean, you have drama schools all over the country, and they're very good. But what happens after drama school, you're sort of thrown out like ants, aren't you, and just crawling around the surface and just hoping somebody... discussing on the shores of sight and see and being cast maybe not for the thing that you're good at.
Yeah.
When in fact, you know, you think I've got this, I can really do this with language or I can do this and that isn't seen. So I think beauty is a huge part of the American industry at the start, and that makes it very hard for a lot of people.
Oh, I relate to that so strongly because, you know, what I wanted to do coming out of drama school and all of that is so different than the career I had. And I don't regret the career I had, but I'm only now coming back onto that path that I originally dreamed I would be on. And True Blood, because I booked that right out of school. I was one of the very lucky few who got right on the show. But watching it back now and thinking about my experience, I see myself learning and growing. It's those 5 years at the RSC that you had, except I was on an Alan Ball show, and I can see where I would make different choices now. But I, at the time, I couldn't watch it because I was too critical. But now I watch it and there's a little bit of grace of like, oh, look at that 22-year-old, you know, who's had a lot of drama school, but is learning. And by the end of True Blood, especially since it was such a crazy show, I left that show going, throw prosthetics, throw blood, throw animals, throw babies, throw anything at me. I've done it in some capacity. I'm ready, you know? And I look at the work I've been able to do since then, and I'm so grateful for the training ground, the proving ground that True Blood was for me.
Yeah, and I think in a way, Alan Ball cast the thing so brilliantly that it was founded by very good actors.
Very good.
Brave actors.
Yeah,
maybe.
Brave. Yeah.
People were just going for it, you know.
Yeah.
I think it was one of phenomenal performances. Yeah. You know, you mentioned Nelson. I mean, just wonderful performances. And you just coming out of drama school and hopping into coffins and into bed.
I was there on the first day I saw it.
Yeah.
Wild.
They just dragged her out of the trunk of a car and threw her onto the
cover
the
me
concrete.
In blood. And then the next day they buried me alive.
And somewhere. And then the next day I kicked you into a grave, funk into a
it's
hole.
Quite an initiation.
And then she had to come out of the dirt. I mean, it was crazy. I mean, we were somewhere out in Deep Valley all night. It looked like some sort of thriller video. I mean, and that was Deb's. Like, hi, welcome to the show.
But Kristen, you and Anna and Stephen were kind of very early. You were like the backbone of the thing because you set up the debate that we all just joined your party. I mean, you were part of that aesthetic.
Yeah. And that was all out of my hands and done brilliantly by Audrey and the people.
Well, you carried these things so well. It was fantastic to have you as a kind of, I suppose, a yardstick, elegant, sort of leathery world.
It was really fun. I mean, it was darn late at night. It was darn cold. But I remember when you had your powers come and became Martonia, we were so cold. And then they brought in a fan. And I saw Rutina's face. They were bringing it behind me. And I saw her look terrified. And I said, what? And she goes, you should see what's behind you. And it was like a 10-foot fan of cold air that was going to be coming at us to create these effects. It was amazing how we did stuff. Everything was practical, like you said, with the bird.
Yeah, and what it did very well was that there was a sort of membrane between reality and unreality that was logically kept very tight. Mm-hmm. I mean, you began to really believe that this could happen in a second. But just by about episode 5 or 6 in my plot, they went a bit mad and I was killing everybody. And I can't remember the plot exactly, but at the very end where I'm in a graveyard where I'm about to be killed. But it's not really right because actually the witches have won this thing. And on stage, somebody said, Fiona, it's a vampire show.
You don't get to win.
We did comment on that, right, Deb? Because the witches won.
Yeah.
And then Bill and Eric are burning at the stake for a really long time. And then someone comes from the dead and talks to you and says, hey, you should stop this.
It's by the grace of Antonia and Marnia that anybody live at the end of that season.
Yeah.
Just
at
by
the end,
their grace. Yeah.
They just say, Marnie just says, oh, okay, I'll give it up. I'll go. And we were like, wait, what?
Choose peace.
He won.
So strange. Yeah. And that way, the writing, obviously somebody got tired.
They were like, look, it's a vampire show. And this is episode 12 of the season. And she was the big bad. So she's just going to give up.
Question about that, like big bad villain, you know, these words, anti-hero, things that we attach to the antagonist of a story, which, you know, was your role for this season. And I'm, you know, again, I'm curious, you know, we asked Dennis O'Hare about this and the kind of the complexity of taking on a role that, you know, do you go mustache twirl and have the fun of that? Do you stay very grounded and give a strong backstory for everything? Or is it something in between and lovely and fun in the middle? And sort of when you know that you're taking on that role, what goes through your mind?
Well, I think Dennis had the best part.
He got to do a little of that. Yeah.
Wasn't he head of every, he was head of.
Yeah. King.
So he really had a ball. And I met him some years later and indeed many times since. And, you know, he still talks about it. I think he really enjoyed it. And it was almost molded to him. I really wasn't suited to playing Marty, but I enjoyed really going into that kind of humble humility that then became monstrous. And actually, there's a truth in it that often very shy people are very powerful people. Anybody shy in my life has always ended up ruling the roost. You know, they're shy until they want their, and they go for it. So I went for the ride. I had no idea where the plot was going near the end. But by then, it didn't really matter. You had two more seasons after that.
Three more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We were together for a long time.
Yeah, it was quite a family.
You know, that's a long time to hang out with the same people.
But did you see each other outside the lot?
Yeah. Yes. I think so. But also, you know, like you said, the hours were so intense on that. You know, I spent more time with the True Blood people on set than I did with my friends outside of set. And then, of course, it does all end very abruptly. And, you know, we haven't done as good a job. It's been, again, one of the joys of this podcast is reconnecting with people and sharing these moments. But, you know, you left. And it was interesting because you came in as a new person, not knowing, being said a little bit lonely. We're in this very intense season, and then that was it. And so what is that like to leave a show after these intense experiences?
Well, it was very emotional for me. And my only sorrow was that we didn't spend much time with the cast outside of the lot. But I think, as you say, we spent 12 or more hours a day on the lot.
Hmm.
But, you know, it was very sad to leave it and sad to go home.
Yeah. It's interesting we talk about those night shoots. And they are very hard and you are very tired and very cold and all the things. But I always have, there's that magical like 3, 4 a.m. in the morning where I am like, yeah, most of our world is asleep and we're up doing this special thing. You know, we're making something and enjoying each other's presence. And I don't know, I always really enjoyed night shoots for that. I'm a good person to play a vampire because I like that 4 a.m. camaraderie. Yeah.
You're absolutely right. That's the bit that I remember is the magic of the outdoors in the middle of the night and that blue light and the air still sort of coming in from the sea and weirdly cold because nothing in Los Angeles is very cold, but those night desert air.
Really gets
you. That place that we shot was a vortex of cold. It was absolutely bizarre. I don't think there's anywhere else in Southern California that would get as cold as Greer got. Well, doing the podcast is fascinating because we didn't hang out outside of work or PR because we were exhausted. And then during hiatus, we all split up and went and worked other places. And also there were so many foreigners on the show, right? So there was a huge amount of foreign cast. And now doing the podcast is when we're, it's somehow cementing the experience that we all had with each other.
Yes.
You know, right? Because you and I may never have seen each other again, but next time I'm in London, I might send you a message.
No, because it's lovely to see you both. Yeah, I love that. But yes, anybody in it hasn't forgotten it.
Right.
You know, I know that Dennis absolutely talks about it all the time. Yeah. I mean,
it's
a huge experience, I think, for anybody part of it, because it was so perfect and so intelligent and so beautiful. And I'm actually not sure whether it could happen this minute. I think the politics would be less welcome just now.
Agreed. Yeah, I do agree with that.
I think
it pushed boundaries, but more than that, it was fair, right? It really tried, like we said, it was conversation and debate. There was no one sided. I think there was a certain leaning, but it felt, you know, it felt like everyone got a voice on some level. And, you know, as long as that voice had something to say.
It's about lots of things that you haven't really analyzed.
Yeah.
But it's about the power of beauty, isn't it? Because the vampires were all beautiful. And so a vampire walks into a bar and everybody kind of notices.
Yeah. Yeah, they're the rock stars.
And so there is that sort of fear of the, you know, the ordinary person frightened of the, of anybody. And it may be a battle between, you know, early Europe and America, that the Germans came there, or the Europeans came, or the aristocratic people who came and took over America versus the ordinary people who just came off boats and worked their way up. So there's a lot about class systems. And Alan seemed to, in my mind, I was hoping to speak more to him. I never did. Alan seemed to hold that in his head. I mean, he stayed with it because he admired it himself, I think, so much.
Yeah, I think so, too.
I think so, too. And we wanted to talk to him more, too, but I was so intimidated by him. And then we got to interview him for the podcast, and it was so incredible. I had pages of questions of things I had wanted to know, but, you know, was too scared to ask while we were filming. And you've had, I saw online somewhere that, you know, you were going to thinking you, there was just one quote where you said you'd like to write a book about your life and growing up Irish and your experiences and in the business. Would you ever do that?
I used to think I wanted to write about my life only because I've had a wonderful life, actually, but I'm not sure anybody would be interested in it. I think I just want to remember it.
I'll raise my hand.
I know. I have a friend who's very interesting, as I find you to be exceedingly interesting, and he says the same thing. So I am encouraging him, whipping him, bugging him, and he's got a blog now, and he's putting ideas down. I love to read autobiographies. It's one of my favorite things. And
yes, maybe memoir. The book I wanted to write was about how I, being Irish, began to understand Shakespeare, which is absolutely anathema to us because we didn't have a happy experience with the British in Ireland in the Elizabethan period, particularly when they sort of behaved like vampires.
Right.
So why did I love this thing? And suddenly the structure of language and the way in which you could do anything with it was like an internet language. But I was very enthusiastic about that. But even since that time, something else has changed. And I'm not sure the things that I know really work about Shakespeare, they would still work because they're embedded in what it is, has got the same charm because language itself is changing. So I fear that my book is already heated all the time. And I think it's much better to not write a book than write a book that nobody might want.
That's true. That's true. But you can write it and never show it to anyone. And I expect as you write, things may come through. You may be surprised, which is what's happening with my friend and actually a project I'm working on, is you sort of write it to see what it is, you know?
Yeah.
It doesn't come out as you thought. And there were some things that you said, the difference, you know, differences with Ireland that I found so interesting and things that I would never have known, even though I have Irish friends. But you talked about the joy of the Irish, that there was a study about financial income or something, and that it is equated with happiness, you know, having a certain amount of stability, except with the Irish. You know, that the Irish can find joy where others can't. And I thought, ooh, that's interesting.
I'm working with the Irish at the moment on a TV series called Bad Sister. You know, and Irish are hysterical all the time. But they do get the work done and they're full of life. But they stopped being, you know, I was trying to say that despite being impoverished, they were happy. Now they're not impoverished either. So as a country, it's a much more buoyant country than England is at the moment. England's really stinking at its, you know, having put a dump of lead around its neck with Brexit.
Yes.
And I think probably America's having trouble with its myths. It doesn't know what it stands for.
340 million people, you know, that's going to be complex.
Yeah. And you've got a lot of opinions and you can't have any one group dominating. And also you can't have the leaders pandering to powerful groups, which is probably where democracy just begins to unravel.
Totally.
I love this because we could be talking about True Blood and the thematics and everything that was brought up in that and the idea of, you know, leaders who stand for something you believe in but are not good leaders or vice versa or, you know, so it's just right in line with everything.
Yes. I think that artistically good often point to the future.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And I'm very bad on it. I was very tough on the theatre here because when big things happened, I mean, the 2011 catastrophe financially, there should have been a feeling in the theatre that that was going to happen. Mm. And I think Black Lives Matter was missed by the theater. It should have been already been discussed. Yes, so then, well, then art fails. But True Blood was so well thought out that maybe it was actually heading towards where we are now. So it's maybe relevant than ever.
Yeah, and that it doesn't date itself.
Yeah.
Okay, so we ask everyone to, when they think of their experience on True Blood, to, if there are three words that could come to mind about your experience.
Three words?
Yep.
New?
Mm-hmm.
Explosive.
Oh, yeah.
Door.
I love it.
Those are cool, Dad.
Those are very cool.
Well, actually, I want to say light as well. Is there a light at door?
Yeah.
I was, you know, with the thing Twilight, and that wouldn't be very good. I mean, I'm very glad that even me as a visitor had some of the experience you had, which is that it was either all door or we were there all day.
Right. Right.
And what happened to you guys afterwards? What did you go into?
I'm now, you know, I have supernatural powers very often, and I kill a lot of people, and I'm deranged. I'm like a serial killer. It's awesome. But it's so interesting because before that, no one would let me play a tough character. Just this isn't how people see tough characters, you know, my fairness and what have you. And now when I try to read for like, because I kind of just want to play a mom where I come in and say, do your homework, Johnny. And I get to be back in my trailer or back at home. And they're like, no. This is where it's at. No,
I had the opposite experience. I went right from that show onto a superhero show, but I was the human. So I went from being the superhero who was the vampire to then being the human. And how do you then, like, what are the super heroic qualities of being just a person who doesn't have, you know, powers of any kind? How do you still have an impact on this world? So that was kind of fun to sway to the other end of the spectrum. And a much more intentionally grounded show as well. So less sort of gothic and more real world in that sense.
In people's sitting rooms, you know, you're in their lounges.
Yeah.
It's not the same as being in movies where people go to a theater to see you. You're coming into the sitting room. So somehow the history of your previous performances is present.
It comes, absolutely. It follows you. And I think just accepting that, kind of accepting that, like, now you get to see that human beings have this range or not, or, you know, whatever it is. And
there it goes again.
There it goes, yeah. And that's okay, that it's okay, you know, Pollock painted this, and he did variations on that, and then he shifted, and that we are artists in that same right and deserve to play. So it's always interesting. But thank you, Fiona, so much for coming to talk with us today.
Yeah, thank you. It was a pleasure to see your face, to hear your voice, to hear your thoughts on the show.
Yeah. Gush time.
Okay. So like
everything we've been holding back while talking to her so that she would think we were cool and not.
We were cool and smart and like legit like she is.
Exactly. I mean, all day. I mean, it has been a little bit of a ride. She's so in demand. It was so, we had to really figure out how to schedule in around her time because it's so generous. Everyone who comes on this podcast does so for free out of the goodness of their hearts and fit into their schedule. And so no exception with Fiona. We are so grateful.
Yeah.
And as soon as we found out this was happening last minute, I've had these little butterflies.
I know.
Because I can't believe I'm going to talk to like a genuine idol, you know, like someone who I really admire. And I I do think I was trying to hold back and not be too sycophantic during the interview.
I know. And it was hard to keep it within the amount of time we had.
I know.
Because you both played Catherine in Taming of the Shrew.
Oh, boy.
I mean, this could have gone. I mean, we just, I know. And, you know, we got it on camera on record that I can ask her to tea in London.
Yes. Yes. She's on the record. You might have to pay. You might have to buy the scones and tea.
No, I'll pay her to have tea with me. Oh. And then she'll get free scones and tea. Yeah, oh, that was incredible. But that was a buzz.
What a treat.
What a treat.
For someone who lives in your mind as such a myth, right, as such a legend of this this industry, this artistry, but to then meet her and have her be so down to earth and have some of the same insecurities. Oh, my hair wasn't great, you know, like
wasn't that, like, that funny? She didn't
that
like
she
her
would
hair.
Have that thought. Reminds you that, like, oh, we are all blown by the same winds, you know, and susceptible to them. And I don't know, that was so heartening.
Yeah, she is actually human.
Yeah, she's actually a human. Not a superhuman, although she is super talented.
Yeah, that was great.
It's been a great season on Truest Bud. Thank you all for joining us. We've loved reconnecting. We hope that you did too. We have 3 more seasons to cover and a whole host of amazing guests lined up,
including Ryan Quanten, Chris Bauer, yay, our own Janina Gavankar, Joe Manganiello, the Viking vampire, my daddy himself, Alexander Skarsgård, and many more.
Thanks for listening, Troopies. Subscribe and follow wherever you listen to your podcast, and we'll see you next season.
Y'all come back now. You're here.
Truest Blood is produced by Safe Haven for HBO. Executive producers are Janina Gavankar, Kristen Bauer, and Deborah Ann Wool. Our producer is Gabrielle Galan, and our audio producer is Christopher Wool. Our theme song was recorded just for this podcast by Jace Everett. Additional music was composed by Timo Chen. And remember, you can watch all of the original episodes of True Blood on Max.